Welcome to Season 8 of Elevate, the global podcast series of the Elevation Barn community, in conversation with the finest minds shaping the world today. Leaders from all walks of life sharing their stories to elevate yours. If you would like to be part of the international Elevation Barn community, join one of our four-day retreats to advance your higher purpose. Or if you face a business challenge that our international stable of accomplished experts can help you with, please reach out to us at connect@elevationbarn.com. We look forward to hearing from you soon. In this week's episode of Elevate, we welcome the founder and managing director of WFS Advisory Limited, Adam Worthington, in conversation with Harry Krakalo, founder of Glee Capital, as they delve into the electric vehicle revolution's impact on automated driving. Together, we will explore the incredible changes beyond transportation this movement influences, from decarbonisation to smart cities, and to the influence battery dynamics will have on the energy arms race for humanity. Gain insights into safety, sustainability, and urban transformations, addressing challenges and opportunities in this groundbreaking shift.
Hi, everyone. It's great to see you. Some new faces and some familiar ones. Welcome today to our Elevate series that we do, shines a light on inspiring global leaders and their professions to bring knowledge and insights to our Elevation Barn community. We have Harry, I'm going to get your surname right. He's the founder of GLY Capital Management, which is a fund that invests in electric vehicle supply chain. He's now the co-founder of Geely Group, which owns Volvo, London Black Cabs, Lotus, just a small amount of businesses there. Henry's a world-renowned leader in the future of global green investment. With years of experience and deep knowledge of the electric vehicle industry, he's the perfect inspiration and guide for us all to learn about the future of green mobility and the hottest trend, whether it's safe, clean, and investable, as it's said to be. In this conversation, we have the wonderful Adam Worthington, who's a member of our Elevation Barn alumni. He's an expert in the renewable energy investment and energy resource sectors within Asia. Adam has over decades of experience when establishing investment infrastructure platforms within water, power, renewable sectors for companies such as Macquarie Group. He was a founder and managing director of WFS Advisory Limited, focusing on the execution and distribution of deals across the Asia infrastructure, renewables, energy resources, and technology sectors. Adam will navigate us today in the ever-important conversation on the future, the electric future, and what we're all facing. So without further ado, I'm going to hand you over to Mr. Worthington.
Thank you, Emma, and Will, and of course, the Elevation Palm team, and of course, Harry Kirkalo for joining us today. Good morning to those in Asia, and good evening to those in the US. Please grab the relevant coffee or a glass of wine and enjoy the journey that we're going to have over the next hour. Harry, I think context is quite often important. Before we kind of dive into the detail, I guess you're a Croatian kid that grew up in Australia, ultimately ended up having a very successful career in finance and investment across Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, Macquarie Group, name a few. But then you ended up on my balcony a couple of years ago with a glass of wine saying that you wanted to do a partnership with a Chinese car company. Now, I've heard of people going through midlife crisis and buying Porsches, but being in partnership with a Chinese billionaire was an unusual one for me. So perhaps a bit of context around that decision and why the Geely Group ultimately here.
Thanks, Adam. I guess, you know, the Macquarie and the Morgan Stanley, you mentioned had a few jobs. I think part of it is obviously couldn't hold on to a real job. Maybe that's part of the context of it. I think it's something to be said about being fired from some of these jobs. I actually did really, I really wanted my lifelong ambition to work at Goldman Sachs or a Morgan Stanley, and I had the opportunity to do that. And just within the confines of our little, I guess, you know, a little circle of friends here, I hated it. You know, it was just a room full of people that somewhat insecure about themselves and their position. And look, the opportunity came up just through chance that I was doing some consulting work for the Zhejiang Geely Group. And the Zhejiang Geely Group itself is quite a large entity. It's got Volvo and Proton and Lotus and its own sort of space and all other stuff. And it had an interest in financial services. And just by pure fluke, I was doing some consulting work for them. And at the end of it, the chairman, through his the CFO, said, look, we really want to, I guess, you know, be at the forefront of transitioning our company from just a car company to what essentially is going to be the new service model as we think about how people interact with transport. And for me, it just got me thinking about the industry. I was already doing some work for them, but in getting to know the company, it really opened my eyes as to the opportunity set that's kind of in front of us, or for me for, as an investor, but also the opportunity to deploy capital for good purposes. You know, we were looking at things that essentially decarbonize the world, and this movement to electric vehicles and a trip economy was something that was at the forefront of, you know, this, what I thought was a traditional manufacturer's mindset. And so the opportunity that sort of presented me, I just couldn't refuse it, to be honest with you. First of all, it was deep insight into an industry which is being massively disrupted. And secondly, it's something which I think people can genuinely be passionate about. And so it was an obvious choice, Adam. And the fact that I was out of work as well probably helped.
Sure. Look, I think you've been quite humble there. But as has been alluded on the call as well, Geely, I guess, owns Volvo, Lotus, Proton, Daimler, Volvo Trucks, flying helicopters, in addition to just being the largest private car manufacturer in China, where electric vehicles, that's the number one electric vehicle market on earth. So tell us, what are the top two or three hottest tech or trends that you're seeing in the industry these days?
Look, I wouldn't say there's just one thing. It's a confluence of things that are just moving really, really quickly together, which I'm really excited about. Because it doesn't happen in isolation. If you think about it, you produce a car, but you still have to support it with the upstream and downstream services to either produce the car, and that could be through battery tech or through radars and LiDARs that make the car smarter. But then you have to support the servicing of it, as well as the customer experience in charging through infrastructure and downstream services. So the whole industry is changing. But what I'm actually most excited about, quite honestly, is the fact that people are moving away from cars. So there's this concept that we are moving greener just because people are buying more Teslas. Maybe we can kind of touch on this a little bit later, but the technologies that I'm most excited about are how I think people are thinking about pricing in trips as opposed to just the cost of a car, and more efficiently engaging with mobility services. So I really like the idea of people walking, right? That's not something we can invest in necessarily, unless you're, I don't know, so I buy Nike or something. But the idea of, well, am I using the right transport service for what I'm about to do, right? Do I need to get in my car? What's the cost of doing that? Not just to me personally, but just to the social and economic wider impact of me using a car. Should I use a scooter? Should it be electric? Is being electric any good? And so I really love some of this shift in mindset. And the technologies that enable that mindset are the things that I get really excited about. So the most obvious ones are things like you've got, you know, the Grab and the Ubers and so forth. But the other ones are more, I guess, supply chain orientated. So we're investing in a company right now which reduces the error rate in GPS from around 5 meters to 3 centimeters. So when you have your phone and you're trying to get your Uber or trying to contact anyone, there's an error rate of 3 to 5 meters on getting that precise geolocation of you. And part of that is satellites work exceptionally well, but they don't necessarily triangulate well all the time because of atmospheric inputs that that are just part of trying to find where you are. This particular company that's a US entity called Swift Navigation has an algorithm that just reduces that error rate, and it reduces it with the current infrastructure that's available, but then it supplements that with additional triangulation points to make the error rate almost, you know, not necessarily infallible, but to a point where it will enable things like autonomous vehicles. Because if you think about, you know, using a 3-5% error rate GPS system to navigate your car through a map in a particular geo-fenced area is not going to work. You're not going to, 3 to 5 meters isn't going to work, you know, as an error rate. You know, you'll end up hurting yourself or others. But 3 centimeters is starting to be really viable, and that technology will then accelerate because of this particular enabler. So, yeah, they're the types of technologies that I really like. And I guess the last reason why I really like it is we can validate it. Right, so I don't have to take a guess as to whether that technology is good or bad. I can ask the Volvo engineers or Geely to tell me, hey, is this good? How does it stack up? Would we use it? And that gives us an edge also as an investor when we deploy capital.
Sure, thank you. So I guess you touched on automated driving. What's your thoughts around automated driving? When will it be coming to the streets? Will it be safe? And how is the industry thinking around, this and then consumer adoption as well?
Well, in short, I want it to happen tomorrow because just empirically, you know, autonomous vehicles are better than human drivers. And I include myself as one of those drivers, even though I love cars. My wife constantly reminds me of the number of accidents she's had versus myself. But look, to some extent, we're getting there and we'll get there quickly. It's more just about the perception of what happens in an accident, who bears liability. For some reason, you know, we kind of accepted that as part of driving, if a human hurts another human with a vehicle, you can kind of, I won't say it's acceptable, but it happens, right? But if it's an automated vehicle, in other words, a computer killing a human, we find that less acceptable. The human tragedy is still the same, but all of a sudden we start thinking about, well, who bears ultimate responsibility? How did this even happen? Why are we doing it? Computers are taking over the world. Oh, my God, the Terminator series is absolutely correct, right? So I think we kind of leap very quickly to a doomsday scenario, whereas if we kept a more empirical mindset, you know, and accepted, if you will, a small amount of error rate in exchange for, if you will, you know, being able to live with ourselves that a human did it versus a machine, then I think that we'd get there a lot sooner. So it's about regulation and it's about social acceptance. But I guess, you know, for those that don't know, there is some level of autonomy already within your cars. So the US government has a society of engineers that have developed 6 categories. And the categories that just label us to what extent there is autonomy in any one vehicle. And the reason for labeling or setting up these categories is that it helps consumers know what they get. It helps insurance companies to some extent, price discriminate on cars that have additional safety systems in them versus those that don't. And the last one is about regulation. To what extent can we let a semi-autonomous versus fully autonomous car available and where? And you know, just quickly for the benefit of those that haven't been introduced to these 6 categories, you know, level 0, is not an autonomous car, right? You might have some form of proximity warning as you back up, there's a beep, but essentially the car itself is incapable of taking any action. It will warn the driver, but requires then the user to do something upon that warning. Level 1 autonomy allows the car to have some form of limited control based on external information from its surroundings. So this could be something like lane assistance where, you know, you're starting off to drift and, you know, your steering will vibrate just to get you back or something where you can regulate your speed in a traffic situation. But the key here is that you still need the driver to be hands-on and continual oversight. Level 2, we're now starting to get a little bit more automated. A car may be able to do slightly more advanced maneuvering. So think about that lane assist, or maybe now it can actually move into that other lane, or you could get out of it and it could self-park, right? But the human still has to be there and ready to take action. Level 3, now is just an extension of level two. It still requires human oversight, but the car now is capable of some form of autonomy. And then level four is where my car companies are aiming. They kind of think that if you're going to have an autonomous car, you know, to what extent do you really have to rely on the human? And by definition, is it really autonomous? So most car companies are now offering level one and two and trying to jump three, go straight to four. And level four is where the car can operate autonomously, except in a fail-safe situation, a human will have to take over. So the example is where cars autonomously driving around, but there's an accident up ahead. The car at level four should now be able to stop itself or pull over to then let the human take over just through that tricky situation. But essentially, it's an autonomous vehicle. And as far as where we are, companies are aiming for this now. You know, 22, 23, this will be an over-the-air update. And then whether the regulation allows us to then fully implement this sort of technology on our roads is less questionable. And then, so just to round that off, the last level, level five autonomy is where you just don't have a steering wheel, right? You sort of get in your little cocoon, and I'm not sure what the good folks at Elevation Barn would do. They put on some form of avocado or mask, is that right? You know, just to smooth out wrinkles. Everyone's beautiful on this particular podcast. I assume that's what you guys do. And just let the car take you wherever you want to go. And so level five is the ultimate. We might not get there as soon as we can, but the technology is getting really close.
So look, thanks for that framework. It actually provides a good, I guess, let's say, engineering background as to it. But from a practical perspective, how do you see this happening? And I guess you mentioned regulatory environments, and regulatory is one aspect to it. Consumer is another. But kind of under what situations do you think we're going to start seeing autonomous driving starting to be rolled out?
Well, it's started already. So yep. The simplest use case is in a well-defined geofenced area. So just think of a truck like on a construction site or a mining site, maybe not a mining site, we don't like mines. It's just basically ferrying children from a kindergarten in one spot. It's going from one spot to another, predefined route. There's not a whole lot of deviation that needs to happen. That can happen autonomously, you know. And that is already, as I mentioned, taking place. The next stage is you think about kind of the complexity of the environment is a geofenced area that is well defined, but is once again just a larger, slightly more complicated, but still a fixed route circuit, such as a campus or an aged care facility. I guess as we then move into where next we'll find it, the autonomy, it will be in highway cases or simple urban environments, because the highway, if you think about it, is essentially a closed end environment. There's not too many children crossing highways or cats or dogs running across. There's a pretty well-defined space there, which we can, with good degree of confidence, know what's going to happen. And then the last place where you'll get the autonomy is in a fully urbanized environment, which is complicated. There's all forms of complexity. There's a whole lot of humans. Humans make things complicated, as do animals and other surroundings. So, you know, it will happen, but the autonomy will happen. It's just that where and when and how quickly we get there is then a function of both regulation and the tech itself. But the tech's ahead of the regulation.
Understood. Thank you. So I guess just changing tack here a little bit, we've just had let's say a bit of a confusing agreement under COP26 with government signing up. Let's talk about the decarbonisation of as a result of electric vehicles. How important is it? And will the electric vehicle actually save us here, or is it just part of the overall solution?
Yeah, good. That was a bit of a disappointment, right? From phase out to phase down on coal, that kind of sucked a bit, but the rest of it was good, right? So, look, the transport industry makes up, you know, it's 10% of global GDP. So it's a big contributor to environmental degradation, gas house, CO2 production. And apart from CO2, it's just a large human cost, right? So around, and I hate quoting stats because I'm getting senile and I forget them. But I think in 2015, a little over 1.2 million people died, fatalities on roads. And the World Health Organization estimates that somewhere around 3 odd million people die because of pollution, be it transport, originated or otherwise. And so there is this phasing out of internal combustion engines that's happening at a macro level. Governments are phasing them out. By 2050, you pretty much won't be able to buy a internal combustion engine. It will all be electric. The Nordics in particular are doing that from 2030 onwards. And I think the UBS had a recent report out to say that, look, you know, even before 2050, by 2040, once again, virtually all sales of cars will be electric. I think that's increasing from 20-odd% in 2025. So there's a big ramp up. And I guess, you know, what does that mean for cars and people in the car industry? It means a whole lot of disruption. You know, almost one in two mobility players will have to either will be gone, you know, or have to redefine their business models. And apart from the social element and, if you will, the macro policies that are being put down by governments, people just like electric cars, right? There's a concept here that A, it's better for the environment. A, it's a better user experience. Just as a side note, the electric motor has around 20 moving parts in it. You compare that to a internal combustion engine motor, it has 2,000 moving parts. So you can just see there's more things to go wrong with an internal combustion engine, more upkeep, more maintenance. So the user experience is better. The cost to run is cheaper. And because there's less moving parts, the car's also more reliable. So, you know, there is this macro as well as a groundswell movement towards electrification. But, you know, in itself, the car, I don't think it's the end game, to sort of come back to your point. It's certainly a great starting point. Like if we think about CO2 emissions, the average electric vehicle to produce will cost, if you will, the environment in terms of CO2 production around 8 to 10 metric tons. And that depends on what kind of battery you've got. The smaller the battery, the less carbon we need to produce it. An internal combustion engine, just to produce, costs a bit less. It's about 7 metric tons. So at the moment, as soon as you buy a car, an electric car, you're not really doing the world a favour, right? In fact, if you bought the internal combustion engine, the footprint in just the production of the car itself is a better result. However, part of that is because of production efficiencies as well. Once you get scale, that will come down. But the big part is battery, right? And what goes into the battery. And that's getting better as well as battery efficiencies and technologies, especially around lithium extraction, get greener. But once you've actually got the car and you're using the car, the electric car is a more efficient and a more environmentally friendly emitter, right? I mean, it could emit zero versus an internal combustion engine. And I think over the lifetime, an internal combustion engine car, I think it's 5 odd years, 12 odd thousand kilometers a year, it will emit around 50 metric tons of CO2. Now, internal combustion engine really depends on where it's getting its power from. If it's a green grid, then that'll be zero, right? Now, most of our grids aren't zero. You know, there is still coal, fire, and you know, we haven't transitioned quite yet to the green grid, being wind, solar, hydroelectric. Yeah? So even when we charge our electric cars, over the lifetime, we will have consumed around 28 or 20-odd metric tons of carbon dioxide. So you're better off, and the payoff for the electric car is around 2 years. So you buy your electric car, you're not necessarily doing the world a favour, but 2 years into ownership, you've now taken over the, you know, as far as what kind of emitter you are having with the electric car versus the internal combustion car. So I probably should have started with this particular sentence first, is that, you know, the least efficient electric vehicle is still better, even if it's powered with the dirtiest power source, than the most efficient internal combustion car. But coming back to your original point, is this the end game? No, right? And I think this is where we could maybe learn from Indonesia, right? Because 1 kilowatt of energy will move a internal combustion engine around 1 mile. What, that same unit of energy will move an electric vehicle around 4 miles. And once again, using that same unit of energy, 1 kilowatt hour, will move a scooter 80 miles, right? So if we're really thinking about, well, what's best for us as a what's the most efficient mobility solution? Where can I really reduce my carbon footprint? Well, it's not necessarily with car ownership at all, right? It's the use of a car potentially combined with a scooter, public transport, as I mentioned, walking. Get yourself a pair of skates. I haven't seen them for a while. Bring back the roller derby, right? You know, I think we have to think about that. One of my compatriots, he described, you know, the walk buttons you push at pedestrian walkers. He described it as a beg button, right? You have to beg for traffic to stop and the man to go green before I get to over. And I love that concept, this idea of, you know, why are we prioritizing what is essentially a pretty inefficient form of transport? And it's not just with beg buttons because pedestrians don't have everywhere to walk, as they don't in Indonesia. It's everything from, you know, car parks to highways and how much is spent on the maintenance of roads that allow us to use cars, which happen to be pretty inefficient when it comes to, A, how we might want to get around in the future, and, 2, what we're doing for the planet.
No, look, I think that's kind of, it's interesting a couple of levels here. It's not going to solve all of the problems here, particularly if the grid is actually coal-fired generation. Hopefully, as the world moves along this energy transition to more wind, more solar, more battery, more geothermal, et cetera, I guess that will then help out in helping actually the electric vehicle reduce carbon over time there. But then you started to touch on, I guess, smart cities and I guess the associated infrastructure with, I guess, electric vehicles. I guess I'm an infrastructure guy, so I've got a bit of a background around this, but I'm interested in how you think about smart cities, how people are transitioning or how cities are actually transitioning towards a smart city. And then how the electric vehicle interacts with that as well.
Yeah. Well, there's a comment on the chat here from Mikey, right, who mentions that Amsterdam will only allow electric cars and other green vehicles into its city from 2030, which is maybe a first step in a smart city, right, introducing a congestion charge and then preferencing, if you will, electric vehicles, into areas, particularly into areas that are, you know, highly urbanized, right, to minimise tailpipe emissions. It's a smart first step, right? Even without being electric, right? It's already a city that's on its path to what is essentially a solution, and as such, I think of it as a smart step forward. I guess, you know, the infrastructure that we need to then enable what I think is not necessarily electric vehicles but the trip economy is what we should be thinking about, right? Like, how do you prioritise places where people that are using mobility services like Uber to be dropped off quickly and easily, right? Or how do you prioritize public transport and more efficient ways for us to move around over, once again, a car itself? So that, I think, is the first macro point. And then if we are, and we're not going to get away from car ownership because it's a convenience, right? I've already bought the car. Don't tell me I'm going to use a scooter, right? And the other thing with electric cars, and I forgot to mention this, is that even though some of the governments may be phasing out sales of electric cars, you don't really replace a car every year, right? Your ownership is, what, once every 5 years? For me, it's closer to 10. I've got 3 kids, they ruin everything. So, you know, what's the point of having new stuff anyway, right? So, you know, I'm replacing my car not that frequently. So first you have to have this phase out, then you have to have the replacement. So internal combustion engines will be there for a while, and there will be a slow and gradual washing out, if you will, to electric vehicles. And I guess one of the things that people think about when they in the context of smart cities in particular, Adam, is what happens to the electricity grid, right? And what do I need to do to maintain the grid? Oh my God, I'm going to all of a sudden, you know, not have capacity. And the fact is that because you're washing out slowly and replacing cars, there is an opportunity for cities to put in that infrastructure, right, to change methods of generating power to be greener. That is sort of in lockstep with the transition to an all-electric fleet. And so I'm quite confident that cities will be able to do this and support on a downstream level the user experience with electric cars. And then as far as cities adopting for autonomy, I think that will happen kind of as a matter of course. One of the things that Elon Musk did quite well, and I'm really impressed with him, he changed the concept of what is a car insofar as you don't just buy it and then it's in your garage and the car that I bought is the car that I drive out of the showroom. Now, when you buy a car, you're also buying it for the research and the over-the-air updates and what the car could become, you know, as the car brand itself develops the technology for the car. And those technologies will make the car far more interactive with the infrastructure and the surroundings. So vehicle-to-vehicle communication or vehicle-to-infrastructure to communication will make our cities connected, autonomous and electric. And I think that will sort of happen lockstep, you know, as we get through with the rate of adoption on EVs.
So I guess a simple example of this could be where, I guess, we get in our autonomous vehicle, we go to the shop, the autonomous vehicle goes through and not only is talking to, I guess, the other vehicles on the street, but then is linking into the buildings around us. Yep. To make sure that we don't crash into them. Also, the bus stop or the pedestrian crossing where we've got sensors all around us. But then even when we get into, for example, we're going to the shops and you can actually put your order for the burger you want or the Coke you want at the shop and then that is delivered to your car. Like, is this where we're heading towards here or...?
The party, but I think you're missing out a big portion. What you're talking about is an automated drive-thru. My advocacy is, hey, first of all, you're going to eat a burger, walk to get it, right? Get off your ass and get that burger yourself, right? So maybe that's the first step, right? But, okay, let's assume you have to, you know, you're not getting off your ass to go get that burger. Well, maybe, you know, the trip economy will allow you just to order it in, right? So with the connected fleet that we've got with Grab and Ubers, right, there'll be an efficiency in how you can get that burger into your gut, right? And it doesn't necessarily involve a complicated network of connectivity in your own vehicle. It's already existing with more social forms of infrastructure, you know, such as an Uber. And so I think that's possibly where it's headed. But you are right insofar as this car, you know, will interact with its surroundings to enable you to be hands-off steering wheel, mind-off driving. You know, you can go in and listen to your favorite Tim Ferriss podcast or Elevation Barn podcast as you are, you know, on your journey and, you know, go about in a more efficient manner to get that, you know, to get to wherever you need to go.
Look, you've briefly mentioned batteries a couple of times. I think batteries represent is a 50 or 60% of the total cost of these electric vehicles. Do you want to just talk us through some of the changes that you're seeing and trends that you're seeing kind of around batteries, kind of given the importance to the overall cost?
Yeah, look, batteries are a big unknown for a lot of people because, you know, our experience with batteries are these phones, right? And that to some extent, I do believe in built-in obsolescence to these things, right? After 2 years, you know, I pretty much need it on charge for it to work, right? If there's not direct electricity current in this, it's not working. The same is just not true with automotive grade batteries, right? First of all, car makers are giving warranties out on batteries, you know, so that, you know, these things cover, I think most of the warranties are 8 years. So you've got yourself covered for essentially what would be the average lifetime of a car. And not only have you got the warranty, there is a minimum degradation, which was, I think, is relatively acceptable. I think the average EV, as far as capacity and range, loses no more than 2.5% per year, right? So after 4 years, you've gone from an electric range of, call it 400 kilometres to, what, 360? And, you know, I don't think people have to be as worried about, A, range anxiety in general. I think they're now coming down from that, especially with the likes of some of the new cars that are coming out with 500, 600, 700, 800 kilometre ranges. But even then, you know, do you really need to drive 400, 500 kilometres on its time? And if it degrades to the point where it's at 400, that's still probably going to be pretty good enough for most people, especially in Hong Kong. I think you could do maybe 10 laps of the island on that. But, yeah, the technology is better than what I think people give it credit for already. So that's the kind of the starting point. And then as far as where it's going. I think it's just getting better. But the part that I'm most excited about is that it's getting better also for the environment, right? So you've got a couple of companies now in the in Europe, a company called Northvolt. In the US, there's a company called Redwood Materials, which is started by the co-founder of Tesla. And they recycle batteries. And the recycling of these batteries is getting to the point where it's so good that it becomes automotive grade again, right? You can repurpose it back into a new electric vehicle. And, you know, you don't have to just sort of fob it off to a power plant or a wind farm. So it ends up within just a storage facility, which in itself could extend the life of a battery or double it almost in some cases. But with the recycling, I think that's a really exciting area. And it's exciting because, A, we get to have the same batteries, but it's also exciting because we're just stopping the movement of minerals, right? Generally, we're moving stuff like lithium and rare earths from one part of the world, be it South America or Africa, you know, into China to get processed. China just happens to do that and process materials particularly well, and then shipped closer to production facilities in the US and Europe, where they're then, you know, cell packed and become batteries. And so just, you know, ignoring the benefits of just reusing the materials, which obviously a massive one because we don't have to mine, limiting the transportation of these materials from one side of the earth to the other is a massive benefit, and obviously a massive improvement in efficiency, which translates once again to an environmental benefit for us as well. So that's I'm more excited about that technology than I necessarily am about just more efficiency in the battery itself from movement from, you know, lithium manganese into a solid state form, or things that coat the anodes to make it more efficient or reduce dendrites. So yeah, it's there's a lot going on in that space.
Interesting. Okay, because I guess historically we've always seen the recharge, a battery that can recharge, but you're actually talking about the recycling of batteries there, which is something that I wasn't aware of and as you noted, it's not just into, I guess, lower forms. You're actually recycling it back up to its original standard there.
Yeah. And automotive grade is a particular, you know, ISO standard, which is of high quality. You know, things that go through an automotive due diligence and validation, you know, generally, you know, very, very well put together. That's something companies have done, be it internal combustion engines or otherwise. You know, they've nailed production, they've nailed logistics. You know, they can do this at scale and they can be consistent and it can be relied upon by the consumer.
Excellent. Look, I do have one other question, but I think this is a good time to actually reach out to the crew here. And Luke, do you want to ask your question? Because I think that this is tying into manganese, et cetera, and how that fits into the battery. Do you want to unmute yourself, Luke? Okay. Well, okay. So I guess Luke's question here is, do you see manganese being a significant or in the evolution of the electric vehicles? I guess his firm is advising a manganese as a major power component. Harry, maybe it might be interesting just to see how you see this, I guess, historically what batteries were made of and what they kind of what new compositions they could be having going forward.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. So you cut out a little bit, but I guess, you know, one of the things that I've learned in doing my job is that in most cases, especially around my engineering team, I am the dumbest guy in the room. So maybe, you know, when I'm taking on this battery chemistry question, I've got, you know, PhDs and people that will tell me far, far greater. But look, what I've noticed as a lay person is that I don't know that people have worked it out yet, right? I don't know, because there's a lot of different battery compositions, right? And there's always a trade-off between capacity and durability and recycle rate. And you're always giving or taking. There doesn't seem to be a perfect solution. What I do know that it's just getting better, right? And you can kind of see that with the car models that are coming out. Range now has gone, it's standard now to have a 400-kilometer range vehicle, right? And that absolutely wasn't the case even 2 or 3 years ago with what was being released. So things are definitely getting better. Whether then they move to a solid state or whether there's different chemistries that will, you know, make that even more efficient, and there are lots of companies working on it. Tesla's, Elon's famously come out to say that he wants to produce the million-mile battery right? And what does that then look like? You know, at this stage, I couldn't really tell you, to be honest with you. And we've looked at a number of companies. There's a lot of them, but I'm just thinking of one which is becoming more prominent now called StoreDot, which did a raising, and we didn't participate in the raising, not because the company, and one of our directors actually sits on its board, we didn't give them money, not because we didn't believe in the technology, just that we thought it was good, but it was not too dissimilar from a number of other companies that had just a slightly different solution. And so are we convinced that there will be a shift and all of a sudden, you know, battery chemistries and technologies will be even better as we move forward? Absolutely. But what the right composition is in those batteries and what it looks like, I think is still up for some debate.
And also, I guess, in the limited work that I've done, I think it also, then there's a big difference between the batteries that are required for cars versus trucks versus motorbikes as well.
Yes.
I think that Mikey...
Thing that I will say, Adam, is that there is a movement to technologies that make the extraction of these materials cleaner. And there's obviously a big movement away from companies that don't support ESG or, artisanal mines in Democratic Republic of Congo that, use, let's just say, unfair work practices. That's being a focus. And all of the car companies are making a commitment to ethical sourcing and accountability in their supply chain, which I think is really refreshing. And that will probably mean things like cobalt will be phased out sooner rather than later.
Thanks. Now, Mikey Van Grootel, I think you had a question around batteries here as well. Would you like to unmute and go ahead?
Yeah, I was wondering, because with Scoot, we are going to start this recycle project with our old batteries for renewable energies. And back in the Netherlands, I also did a pilot years ago, where we tested if you could charge when the sun was shining and make a system for that. I was wondering how you see that technology and how especially do you see it in Indonesia, since the grid maybe is not so stable here, and then we have to focus more on local renewable energy and deliver it maybe to a locally to match demand and supply. So I was wondering how you see that development, and then especially in Indonesia, how can it evolve here and be a solution for the grid and for more renewable energy?
Yeah, gosh, you put me on the spot. I thought we had something going when I acknowledged your good question, Mikey. I wouldn't think you'd throw me under the bus, but here we go. All right. Look, I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I think it's very, each country will find its own. As an example, in Finland, which has an abundant sources of geothermal energy, and they're all of it's green, right, because of just these natural resources, then it's easy for it to transition already, move in that particular direction. That solution may not be the same one that you've got in other countries that don't have that as a natural resource. So I think it's somewhat location dependent. What might be right for Indonesia, even, as an end game, would just not be viable in another country or in another part of the world. So I think they are location specific. But what they are for Indonesia, look, I think Adam's probably a little bit better placed to tell us, about the grid and its load and how it transitions to clean versus coal. All I can kind of comment on is that there is a movement to greenifying and gentrifying, if you will, where we get our electricity from.
Yeah, so I guess this is, as Harry said, maybe more of a question for me, I guess. I've been lucky enough to be investing into wind projects and solar projects over the last 15 years. There's no question that having storage systems next to those solar or wind, et cetera, is actually kind of part of the future. It's not even part of the future. In fact, PLN in its PPA for a project that we were doing in West Timor has actually insisted that you must have with a wind farm, a battery solution next to it. And this is for two reasons. One is to actually help with the volatility of it actually hitting the grid and actually blowing up the grid. But then it's also more just being able to produce a more regular stable flow of electricity over a longer period of time. And there's an interesting company called Brightnight, which we're working with. And usually the way that a solar company would sell their electricity is that they'd say, well, whenever the sun is on, we will just provide you with that electricity. You must buy it from us. Whereas what they're now doing is that they're going to the grid and they're saying, well, we with the battery and using maybe some combining some other renewables together, so solar during the day, wind during the night, and then overlaying that with batteries, what we'll actually do is we'll guarantee you kind of a baseload or a mid-merit amount of electricity, and we therefore, for giving you that electricity on a more stable basis, we want to be able to charge a higher price for that. So this is definitely happening. It's happening in Indonesia right now. I guess a combination of putting different technology, renewables technologies together, but also kind of adding to that kind of the storage element.
Thank you both for your answer.
Pleasure. Ted, you had a bit of a abstract question here. Would you like to unmute and ask this?
Yeah, it seems like it may be a silly little nuisance in some ways, but you mentioned how humans are prone to making things complicated, whether that's being behind the wheel or bagging groceries or just falling all over one another. But I'm finding that that little things like I never had a problem turning a key half an inch. And now that it's all been digitized, I've had several problems dropping my mother off at a restaurant and finding out when I'm parking the car, I can't turn it off or lock it or do any of these things. She drove 3 hours after being with a valet and realized she didn't have the key. So sometimes these technological advances create these problems that are unanticipated. And I guess to me, I wonder who sort of controls the intelligence that matters. How do we shift from making these? My engine light went on the other day and it turned out it was because of the gas cap. And it took me 3 hours to find out that that's what it was. So my bigger question is, I have to trust these engineers and designers to maybe automate my car, and maybe it creates some skepticism on my part that there are things that aren't being considered. So I guess where's the funnel of intelligence, and is it working?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ted. I feel like every question that I'm getting on this Elevation Bar starts off with, well, I don't know, but anyway, so one of the cars that we invested in called Polestar, you don't have a key, you don't even have a button, you turn it on with your butt. So as soon as you sit down, it turns on, right? And is that really necessary? Do I need it? Well, I don't know. Like, I think, you know, car companies themselves do a certain amount of peer review and then also consumer data to work out, well, would a consumer like it? And invariably, when it comes to electric, you are getting a subset of consumer that really likes that sort of stuff, right? They're early adopters, right? Especially when we think about Tesla, they're early adopters even at the cost of manufacturing integrity. You know, Teslas are very well made now, but, you know, before when they hadn't reached scale, their consumers were forgiving Tesla for some production faults where, you know, just because they like the idea of Tesla. I'm an Apple guy, I'm a Tesla guy. And as such, you know, you do get this kind of runaway tweaks to your car. Does your car really need a dog mode? Yeah, that's a cool feature, but does it then need to dance as I get out and, you know, leave my car to show people that it can do that? That's just stupid, right, as far as I'm concerned. It's a waste of time and energy to do it. But I think the real problem, you know, if you sort of take out, if you will, some of the fringe, if you will, elements that are being now put into the production of these cars, is that it's not such a well-supported downstream service that EV buyers are getting. So people that are in the showroom or people that are delivering you your car still haven't got used to answering consumer questions, such as, you know, where are charging stations? Where's the range? What's the degradation? How do I do this with my car or that? Or how's this new feature? So I think, you know, and the reason being is that as far as sales go, you know, we are getting there as far as adoption. But at the moment, people are still buying more internal combustion engines. So the average sale is on an internal combustion engine as opposed to an electric vehicle. And as such, the average is a bad word, right? Every every human has one fallopian tube on average. That's not a very good thing to put out there. But, you know, the idea is that I'm trying to convey here is that the servicing will improve. So you will be explained more about, you know, these nuances within your car and how the capping, affects it or doesn't affect it as the delivery mechanism gets better and people become more familiar, including industry people, about the car itself so they can explain it to you properly. But I agree with you that some of the tech is superfluous when it's in its development and they're just to please a small niche market of early adopters.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd love the car not to work on a sunny day. I mean, that would be a more intelligent solution to get my ass out to get my burger.
Yeah, get the skates on.
Yeah. Thanks.
Pleasure.
So I guess just shifting now to Brett. Do you want to ask a question there?
Yeah, hi. Hi there.
Hi, Brett.
Yeah, g'day. I'm really informative and I'm looking forward to revisiting some of this stuff. It's a real study. So thank you for your depth of knowledge and sharing. I just wanted to bring up that, you know, the car is a powerful symbol of pride and independence and status. You know, there's a whole culture that's built around, you know, the car and employs millions and millions of people. And it's a source of excitement. It's a source of adventure. It's something that, you know, it's a form of pleasure. It's not just a form of transport. So, you know, as we're introducing this idea of hyper automation and hyper safety and all these things are going to make it better. It's also taking away the thrill of the, it's taking away danger, you know, and, you know, the idea of trending towards a hyper safe world in every aspect is not necessarily an aspiration for everyone. So, and it's more a philosophical question, I think, but I'm just interested, you know, your take on that. So that, you know, the three things are, you know, the symbol of the car is culture and status, you know, the trajectory for our world and employment. So just a general.
Yeah. Thanks, Brett. I read your question. I'm like, Adam, get to Brett's question. Get to Brett's question. And the reason being is that, the fact that you're sort of putting, you want me to opine on a Socrates quote, that's brilliant. You know, I mean, I'm not going to put myself anywhere near the standard of Socrates on the philosophical merits of car ownership, but I love the fact that you sort of put me out there. I wish I was wearing my toga or a muumuu around my at the Agora as I sort of opine on this. But you're absolutely right. And the generation that I grew up with, you know, the first thing you did when you were 16 in Australia is you got your learners. And this was an absolute rite of passage. And it was a symbol of freedom. It generally meant more opportunities for sexual exploits. Let's face it, I live with my parents. The Holden Gemini saw a bit of action in the backseat. Not enough as it should have. But in any case, you know, it is a symbol of utter freedom. And, you know, how does that kind of translate to an autonomous car that feels a bit soulless because you're not driving it, it's electric, I can't hear it. I'm just in it to do my Sudoku or play Roblox or whatever people do in autonomous vehicles. And so there is a transition, but the transition is real. And you know, incidents or people are getting their licenses later. In the States, it's already happening. People are as fascinated with getting that license. And part of it is because mobility is becoming now more, not necessarily affordable, is probably the right word. Because if you need the car, you're going to spend 30-odd grand, 40 grand on getting a car. If you want to get somewhere, you can just do it via Uber now more efficiently. And I think this mindset is changing from capital outlay and convenience, which is a big capital outlay, to paying per trip. It is starting to take hold. And I think the quicker we kind of get to this point where we realize that the cost of ownership, if you include maintenance, upkeep, hassle, parking, you know, let alone, if you will, safety, it's just more efficient if I pay up front. It's just that people don't necessarily like the idea of paying, you know, 20, 30, 40, whatever it might be, dollars per trip to go out, even though over the lifetime it's a more efficient and more economical way. But it is moving that way. So we are moving away from, A, the need to sort of define myself with my car, and to the convenience that it gives me. I think that is something that's just happening with a younger generation.
The question is more around, you know, what about, you know, am I going to hit the road and go for a drive in a Mustang or a Triumph? You know, are people going to be able to get insurance in 20 years' time? Is that going to be, am I considered an unsafe person? A risk?
I think you will. No, I think you will. I, you're not a horrible person for wanting a car. you know, even an internal combustion engine, because you like the sound of it. Well, you are a little bit of a horrible person, but that's okay. I think they're not going to go away. Cars, you know, I also love to drive, and quite honestly, I also quite like the noise of a car too. To some, you know, but the experience with an electric vehicle now is getting—it's amazing, right? Like you know, we are. I think there's a quote attributed to Henry Ford, you know, 100 odd years ago, to say, you know, people didn't want faster horses; they just wanted less horse shit, right? Now we're getting to a situation where our cars are faster and producing less horse shit as well. So the idea of ride quality and enjoyment, I think, will be there with an electric vehicle. And then, yes, if you have an internal combustion engine that you want to sort of pop around to just drive in general, I think you will. And that will then be priced accordingly based on, if you will, the risk that you present to the insurance companies. And they'll have a very good sense of that. But if anything, maybe you'll be safer because everything else will be sort of moving out your way. I don't know.
Cool. Harry, let me redirect this a bit more back to investing. Looking at the market cap of Tesla, looks like pretty much everyone on Earth owns some shares in that, given that they've got kind of multiples of the entire car industry kind of combined together into their market cap. You haven't invested into Tesla from the fund, but I'm interested in kind of how you look at investing, how you're doing it, kind of what's the competitive advantages that you have here that you can share with everyone.
Thanks, sir. Look, I guess when we invest, we first have an insider's view on it. So we'll ask Geely what they think, right? And the technologies are valid. How does it stack up to its competitors? Would we give them a contract? And compared to an entity or like a financial institution that doesn't have that level of insight, I think, you know, we are at a big advantage, especially as we sort of navigate this industry, which is being heavily disrupted. There'll be lots of losers, there'll be some winners. And I think that insight of having an operating business is one. But when it comes to things like Tesla, the investments that we look forward are enablers of the macro trends. So, yes, the car, but then, you know, what about the technology that underpins it? Can it be licensed out to other car manufacturers? You know, and that's a far more lucrative business model than just selling the car. Or within the car, what kind of services are there for consumers? Is there a subscription model? Is there a move by the entity to capture what is a larger portion of profit by engaging in mobility as a service? So, you know, we look not just at the car, but we look at investments that enable, if you will, the transition, and in particular, how people might spend their money in that new world. On mobility or within the mobility sector. And so, yes, it's not just about Tesla. But, you know, whether or not then Tesla is justified, look, I don't know. Like, you know, I'm not an analyst of Tesla. But, look, the idea of buying a car and then it going around eventually and chauffeuring other people and then coming back to me like a, you know, like an obedient carriage, if you will, and then plugging into the grid and offloading what it has as capacity energy at peak times to then make me money. I don't know, that kind of sounds pretty cool too, right? And whether there's a business model there eventually, I don't know. But people are pricing in more than just the sales of Teslas, that's for sure. It goes to distributed utility revenues and mobility as a service and upgrade and other things that are not just the sticker price of the car and the margin on the car itself.
And I guess investing in a lot of this tech industry, et cetera, has always been risky. Kind of how do you think about investing in early stage companies? Like, do you do it or do you wait until they've got some track record there, et cetera?
Yeah, well, we want to see some track record. And look, the reason being is if I want to send a company down to our research center or to Volvo in Gothenburg or Hangzhou where we've got, you know, automotive grade testing, the research team can't validate PowerPoints or concepts, right? The widget has to exist if you're going to test the widget. And so, you know, there's an element of, well, I already need it to be produced, I already need some prototype, otherwise the engineers can't do their job. And then the flip side of that, and it works quite well, is that we also need it to be that way because for it to get into the automotive supply chain, you know, it has to be a robust, scalable solution. And you don't get that from a startup. So very rarely will we look at something which is completely nascent. We like companies that are post-revenue but pre-profit, have a concept and then can fit into our research centres for testing, validation, and ultimately receive a purchase contract in a short period of time. and that de-risks it. Obviously, if I know that Volvo is going to, you know, have a heavy interest in it and buy it, then, yeah, of course, I think that doesn't guarantee its success, but it's certainly better than not having that contract in place.
I know, and I think that, thank you, Harry, and I think that's one of the unique things that I see around, I guess, your fund, in that not only can you go through and send that widget to the Volvo team, the Daimler team, the I guess the Geely team, et cetera, to find out whether it's going to work in the next Mercedes C-Class or Volvo XC90, but then you can also go through and see the likelihood of whether that order is actually an order is going to be made by those companies, such that then hopefully you can take this company from producing, I don't know, 100 widgets through to 1 million widgets. And that kind of commercialization angle certainly appears pretty directive. Just one final question, and I guess this is from Chloe, who heads up the young leaders of Elevation Barn. I guess for any young kids coming out of university or school, kind of wanting to get into the industry, kind of what advice can you give them?
That's a tricky one. In many ways, you know, I was about to say, don't get a job at Morgan Stanley, right? Because I hated it and eventually came out of it. The fact is that I think you should. You should actually do things that you don't necessarily like to start off. People always go, oh, I'm just going to now go and change the world and, you know, I'm going to do things that I really love. Well, how about this? How about you get a bit of maturity and you do something that does help or does put you in a professional environment and then use that as the basis to follow your passion? I mean, that would be my advice. It's a bit counterintuitive to just, you know, be a YouTube blogger and try to save the world because that's what I like to do and that's my passion. I love the idea of, you know, going into an industry, learning it, and then deciding, well, what can I use within this industry that does then, you know, fuel my passion and how can I use that as a base? And I think that gives you better grounding than just, you know, airy-fairy kind of, or an airy-fairier, if you will, approach, which, to be fair, does work sometimes, you know. Plenty of good people have sort of just followed a dream immediately as opposed to done anything in the interim and made a success of themselves. But my advice would be, you know, get yourself some grounding first.
Very good. Okay. Well, look, Harry, thank you so much. I'll hand over to Emma now to wrap up proceedings.
Thank you. It was a fascinating discussion. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Adam, thank you for asking fantastic questions for the community. I'd love to carry on, but as time is pushing on, I suppose my final question to you, Harry, is that, you know, us as a global network of industry specialists, how can we help you in your mission?
Thank you. Thank you, Emma. Well, look, I think it's just, to be honest with you, just discussing this helps me. Oddly enough, I get passionate about this subject and just talking with you guys and hearing your questions, you've already helped me because, you know, it sort of puts me in the right mindset for the rest of my day now. But, look, yeah. you know that you can through Adam and come directly to me, talk about things that you find interesting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, we're a private equity fund. So, you know, to the extent that people want to invest or know of people that are interested in this space and can see an edge with us, you know, I sort of had to pinch myself, but, you know, we've gone from zero under management. We now have $1 billion. So it's not inconsequential, but a billion in the context of private equity is still, you know, a drop in the ocean. But we're still a first-time fund manager and we need diversity of LPs. So the idea of people that are interested in coming along for the ride with us on a financial sense, love to know about them. People that have ideas in the sector, you've got some really intelligent people that have asked some great questions or are connected to technologies that we might like, happy to talk to them as well. And then happy to engage and have these sorts of conversations, you know, anytime going forward.
Amazing. Well, we've had quite a few questions banked up in our chat. So what we'll probably do is take those offline and put folk in touch with you to answer them. We've shared your LinkedIn and your contact details. So we can facilitate that after the session for more communication with our community, if that helps. But fascinating chat. And thank you for sharing your amazing insights. Adam, thank you as always, your amazing hosts. Some great cross questions there. And thank you to everyone for joining. And we'll love to keep in touch, Harry.
Likewise, thank you, Emma. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, bye-bye. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us with Adam and Harry. We hope you enjoyed exploring how their lives could elevate yours. And that's a wrap for Season 8 of Elevate. Big thank you to everyone for joining our insightful podcast journeys. To our incredible contributors, thank you for sharing your wisdom, passion, and diverse experiences. We've loved creating a platform where ideas flourish so that lives can too. More engaging discussions and uplifting moments are coming soon on Elevate Podcast Season 9.